Chapter 17. Stony Brook. Once again, I reluctantly left the excitement of our unpredictable life in the New Guinea Highlands, and returned to Sydney to experience excitement of a different kind. This time, to join the first intake of second-year art students into the newly completed Randwick Technical College building, located immediately opposite the Randwick Racecourse. This fancy new facility was a far cry from the cluster of old wooden buildings, in various stages of disrepair, that comprised the National Art School's North Sydney campus, where I'd studied for the year of 1966. I was 18 years old. I continued to live at Tremaine in Kirribilli, because the facilities were exceptional value for money. A single room and full board for $13.50 a week. An additional advantage was that public transport from Kirribilli to the Randwick campus was reasonably straightforward. To get there, I took a train south into the city, and then a bus that took me to the door of the imposing seven-story building. Once there, I alighted, loaded down with all the art-making gear necessary for my classes that day. This, there and back again journey, was repeated Monday through Friday, during term time. The young people who gathered for second year were an interesting mix. Like myself, they had completed first year studies elsewhere. Each of us had both the interest and access to the funds necessary to continue with a formal art training. I made new friends, a number of whom were extremely talented. June Brownlow, the young woman who would become my bestie, had recently moved up from Victoria, where she had been studying at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, another highly regarded art school. She was incredibly attractive, coming from a family of equally attractive younger siblings. Their physical attributes gave the impression that each had been stretched on the rack, as all their limbs were elongated and slender: arms, legs, torso, fingers and neck. June was discovered by a modeling agency and was in demand for both catwalk and photographic work. As a result of her numerous modeling gigs, she spent less and less time with us at Randwick. I clearly remember her asking me if I would like to go modeling with her. I was so surprised, wondering if her desire for my company overrode her ability to realistically assess my anatomical shortcomings, the most obvious of which were my knock knees. Gradually she drifted away from art school altogether, but we remained friends. From the sidelines, I witnessed her rise to modeling superstardom. Later, she married a nice army boy and withdrew to the relative obscurity of the suburbs. But I digress. My first year of art school training at North Sydney Technical College concentrated on developing the foundation skills necessary for a career in the arts. But in second year the bar was raised, as we moved into the next phase of our art training. To further develop our powers of observation, and use them in combination with our now, well-developed, drawing skills, we were required to document what we saw, in a myriad of ways. I've clear memories of three unexpectedly stretching exercises that were set that year, one each for sculpture, drawing, and life drawing. Like all the National Art School campuses, Randwick was staffed by a collection of talented instructors, many of whom were well-known and well-respected artists in their own right. I remember one instructor distinctly. His name was Laurie Wall and he was a sculptor of some note. One morning a week, for a 12-week term, he guided us through the many steps necessary to make a life-size freestanding cast of a human scapula, using plaster of Paris. This involved mastering the complicated process of making a negative mold. We began by making drawings of the scapula from a human skeleton that hung in the corner of the sculpture studio. Next, a metal rod was glued into a wooden base. The rod was used to support an armature, made of fine chicken wire, roughly bent into the shape of a scapula, and soldered into position. Damp clay was then pushed into the chicken wire, and shaped to look like the real thing. I remember this process took weeks. Next came the complicated negative mold-making process, that was followed by casting, and finally, the reveal. I was completely underwhelmed by this excruciatingly long and drawn-out exercise, akin to watching paint dry. At the time, I found the process quite intimidating and didn't imagine how this skill set would be of any practical use in my creative future. As it turned out, for many years I was spared the need to create plaster casts. For my fellow students, interested in pursuing a career producing three-dimensional forms, this exercise would have been extremely useful. Yet another memorable exercise was set by our drawing teacher. We were required to draw water. To do this, we escaped the classroom to sit quietly on a pier overlooking Sydney Harbour in the warm sunshine. We were instructed to watch the water as it moved, to note the shapes created by the wind as it blew across the surface, the subtle effects of tidal currents, and the disturbances created by passing vessels. When we had them firmly fixed in our mind's eye, we recorded the shapes on paper. Back in the classroom, we were then asked to adapt our drawings to create a design suitable for either a watercolor or an acrylic artwork. A digital camera would have been a godsend for this exercise, but digital anything was decades away. Moving up to second year brought with it a much anticipated rite of passage: to make drawings from a naked human body. All through first year, we had been taking turns to model, fully clothed. Now we were to be introduced to life drawing. As an aside, I began to notice an awkward titter when I mentioned life drawing in non-art circles. For some, it seems that the idea of a man or a woman standing, sitting or lying starkers offers the opportunity to indulge in covert sexual wanderings, or puerile giggly attempts to disguise discomfort. But we came to see life drawing as the best way to fine-tune our drawing skills. A different model arrived each week, holding short poses at the start, that led into longer ones, over a three-hour class. Good life models are hard to find. Some non-art folk erroneously assume that modeling for artists is dead easy. True, taking off your kit is easy, but holding a pose for 20 minutes, without a break, is difficult. We came to really appreciate the models, particularly those with less than perfect bodies, because folds of flesh are much more satisfying to draw. Whilst taking a break from life drawing, we'd sometimes gaze out the classroom windows to watch what was happening across the road at the famous Royal Randwick Racecourse. From our third floor vantage point, we had a fantastic view of the buildings and the tracks, bordered by oval swathes of lush green grass. I wasn't from a betting family, but was curious to visit the racecourse sometime, that is, if the opportunity arose. And it did. At one point, I was very broke, hanging out for the monthly top-up from my father. As I bemoaned my financial situation, a group of fellow students, who understood racing, suggested a lunchtime dash across the road to back a winner in an attempt to relieve my cashless predicament. What a good idea! This was my first visit to a racecourse, and I was surprised to note that the midweek race meeting atmosphere was unexpectedly laid back. I noted groups of well-turned-out punters as my more worldly friends guided me through to the line of bookmakers, standing ready to take my money. Ever hopeful, I tried to convince myself that a successful bet would magically multiply my last $5. My friends carefully explained the betting process for a win, a place, an each-way bet, or a trifecta. I then selected a horse at random, possibly drawn to the jockey's colors, and, to keep it simple, I decided to back it for the win. It was all or nothing. Sadly, it was nothing. I'd done my dough. Overwhelmed with disappointment, we slowly straggled back to college for the afternoon class, and afterwards, I recall having to borrow money for my bus and train fare back to Kirribilli. Sadly, my personal life in the early part of 1967 was equally disappointing. I had a protracted breakup with the angel-voiced Paul Patent, and as a result, was nursing a seriously broken heart. My Tremaine friends were very supportive and caring, as I was a long way from familial support, with my mother living in New Guinea and my father in Kenya. A number of friends were kind enough to take me home to their families for a weekend getaway in the country. Goulburn and Cowra were standout excursions, providing a welcome change of scene as I worked my way through my emotional distress. It took months for my broken heart to heal. And, from then on in, I decided to adopt another, hopefully less painful, modus operandi. I would play the field, in the hope of finding genuine affection. Buoyed by the naivety of youth, I erroneously assumed that I possessed sufficient judgment to ensure the next intimate relationship would be better than the last. How wrong I was. As my first term at Randwick drew to a close, I was once again off to New Guinea for the midterm holidays. I was looking forward to a short break from the art school routine and the bleakness of a Sydney winter. I left Sydney, not knowing what would happen during my two-week stay in Goroka, because it was always impossible to predict. On reflection. Art school. My mother, who was art school trained, was delighted that I'd decided to pursue a career in the arts. Growing up, I'd shown all the signs of a creative disposition, so she chose to believe that I could follow in the footsteps of her famous artistic family. To be honest, as I'd done so badly in my final secondary school examinations, I was short of alternatives. Not being interested in much else other than stylish dressmaking, and anxious to please, I toddled off to art school each weekday, for a 9 o'clock start, and worked through to 5 o'clock, with breaks in between. I rarely missed a day. Driven by my family's uncompromising work ethic that was reinforced by 2 years spent enduring the rigidity of a boarding school routine, I was compelled to turn up and do what was required. In addition, I really enjoyed the subjects taught, as well as the collegiate atmosphere created by my classmates. The races. I am thankful I wasn't raised in a gambling family, and even more thankful that my brush with betting at the Randwick racecourse was unsuccessful. Perhaps if I'd backed a winner, things may have been different? The failure to win experience brought with it unexpected benefits. Since I visited the racecourse that day, I've not placed a bet on any other fast-moving animal. However, I must confess to once visiting Flemington Racecourse for the horse race that stops the nation, the Melbourne Cup, just to say I'd been there. On that day, I placed no bets and drank no booze. Nonetheless, I had a wonderful day, enjoying the fashion and the flowers.